Good morning, and welcome to the July 8th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my guest co-host, Catherine Bergler. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by talking to author Matt Bean. He's going to be discussing his new book, The Skill Code, about how technology has altered the landscape of human skill development.
Then we'll be joined in the studio by Will Manhart of Local Waters Fly Fishing and Katie Holyfield of Lucky Ones Coffee, people who run two very different businesses and happen to be married. We will finish our hour with Joe Ogdy and Alex Hudson of Blue Sky, who will fill us in on all that's going on there this summer.
All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. For 20 years, viewers have loyally watched the popular television show Grey's Anatomy, where interns seek to learn the skills associated with being a surgeon under the watchful eyes of residents and attendings. The development of skills using an expert novice model has been around for centuries, but that model is threatened by new technologies with profound implications. Author Matthew Bean does a remarkable job of laying out the challenges to skill development in the age of intelligent machines in his new book, The Skill Code. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Matthew, and thanks for being here.
Good morning. Delighted to be here.
Matt, what inspired you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
The research is about 12 years of work. I started in about 2011, really, but in earnest, maybe 2012, always studying how people put AI and robots to work at work, and in particular, what that means for how we build skill. And I'd say the moment that really woke me up about this as an important topic, maybe not to write a book, but certainly to focus my career on, was watching the stark difference between how folks tried to build skill in traditional surgery and robotic surgery. This is like from the inside of the operating room, kind of watching and gathering data. And within a week, seeing that everyone was trying just as hard with the robot in the room and just abysmally failing, struggling, not really learning. So that was the sort of grounding wake-up call for me that led me to spend the rest of that time trying to figure out how broad a problem this is and what we might do about it.
And how is this emblematic of the challenges to skills transfer? Is this challenge really the only presented to a small number of occupations?
Yeah, no, so originally the research I did in robotic surgery led me to think it shouldn't just be isolated to surgery, but I needed more data to validate that intuition. I've since looked at over 30 occupations in many different industries and different technologies, and the core problem that you can see in vivid detail today with technologies like ChatGPT and Anthropic's Claude is that with intelligent technologies in their hands, an expert can do much more by themselves. Novices are optional now, or much more optional than they used to be. And that's great for the expert. They feel more competent, they can solve more complex problems faster. And the organization that hired them loves that too, because they're just getting more value per unit time of that expert's work. The novice is left out in that equation. This is the person trying to become that expert. And when they're optional, novices are slower and make more mistakes across all these contexts I've studied. And so it's a very rare exception where the novice is better off because of these new intelligent technologies in terms of their skill development.
Let's go back to the operating room. You set the stage early in the book and are discussing sort of the development of a new surgeon and what happens when they sort of haven't had the opportunity to do the regular skill development that we might see under a traditional method. Can you flesh out a little bit that story?
Right. No pun intended there. And trust me, I won't get graphic. But in short, if you walk into the operating room as a resident, picture your Grey's Anatomy person and you're looking to learn, you've spent an entire career basically getting ready for this moment. You walk in, you help dock a four-armed, 1,000-pound robot to a patient, and you attach its instruments, four instruments, through keyhole incisions into a patient in their abdomen, say. And once that robot's set up, then you and the attending surgeon rip off your scrubs, walk 10 feet away to these two control consoles that can control this robot, and you sit down and you watch for 4.5 hours, the whole procedure. The attending knows you need practice. They want to give you control of this robot, but they also know you're going to be slower and make more mistakes. And they have a patient on the table. So if you are optional, you are not going. At the top flight teaching hospitals I study, 18 across the U.S., that you'd end up, instead of being on task for 4 hours, 4.5 hours, the entire procedure where it took four hands to do the work, you're looking at 15 minutes of operative time. But by the end of that residency, you're legally empowered to use that tool. You're going to head off to another hospital and be expected to use it, but you are woefully under-equipped.
Yeah, the scary part was when you described how long someone who lacked that training might take to perform a robotic surgery.
Right. And of course, I don't have systematic data on this. And I should say there is data that suggests that this technology, like the profession has learned, and that the learning curve might be getting over it and so on. So I don't want to make it sound like it's all scary. However, you are looking in many, many cases, looking at somebody who has rarely used the tool during their training, does not feel confident with it, and yet the hospital has made a big investment and is looking for a return. So they're going to get a lot of pressure to use that tool at whatever hospital they land in.
Matt, you argue that skill development is governed by a skill code that has three essential elements: challenge, complexity, and connection. And you devote a chapter to each of them. Let's start with challenge. Why is it important?
Right. I discovered this through my own research by watching people who did manage to learn robotic surgery at first, but then in other tools and other technologies. Those who did manage to learn found ways that strained the rules to get access to practice and working in procedures that really pushed them close to the edges of their capability. They were very uncomfortable, performing less well than they might have, and were very focused. But it turns out, across more than 13 scientific disciplines — this was the great luxury of writing this book — I found that, in fact, it's very obvious across all of them, everything from sports psychology to kinesiology to psychology, sociology, anthropology. Humans don't really develop skill well unless we are in that space. We are not happy. It is not pleasant. We might even literally be sweating. But we're not doing as well as we could in that moment. But that's where humans develop ability. There's an entire research domain in psychology known as desirable difficulties. In many ways, this difficulty, the struggle that we need in order to learn, is exactly what novices were deprived of. A few systematically found ways to protect that, and that was my way of, like, watching and learning from them is what taught me about challenge being really critical.
So what happens if there's too much or too little challenge presented in the workplace?
Just less learning, less skill, less quality skill development, either way. And you highlighted a critical point there, which is you can obviously have too much challenge. I mean, we lionize sort of Devil Wears Prada style mentorship where, you know, you're lucky if I pay attention to you, go do this impossible task for me in 3 minutes, that kind of thing. And of course, some exceptions will always prove the rule. There will be people who point to a trial by fire style learning as critical to their learning, when in fact, for the average human, that's just not, it's going to burn them out. And what I'm seeing, though, primarily is the lack of challenge that comes from the limits to novice involvement that are subtly boiling up in the economy. And those are, you're just not engaged. You would love to be participating, but you couldn't find a mentor to save your life. The expert can just do more by themselves.
And you give examples of people on a factory floor of the sort of relationships between lack of challenge and too much challenge and adequate challenge. Can you sort of explain sort of a more concrete example of what we're trying to do here?
Sure. So and actually the factory floor one bleeds between challenge and the next C in that three C's, which is complexity. So I can maybe touch both briefly on both. The way that we organize production in, say, a warehouse or a factory now is we design jobs to be very narrowly focused. We give you a hyper-focused task to do repetitively over time. And there are industrial engineers crawling around that factory in any organization of appreciable size whose job it is to make that job simpler over time so that you reduce the likelihood of errors. Because the business makes money where you pass more goods through that building at higher quality. So you want to reduce the amount of skill required to do that job. If you're doing your job as an industrial engineer, that means a reduction in challenge for that human. But it also means a reduction in complexity. Complexity is the second component of skill development that's really crucial, which is, well, we often think of skill as a sort of progression to getting good at a task. For a surgeon, it's tying a knot. For a line manufacturing person, it might be assembling a good. Get good at that thing. But in fact, a healthy progress towards skill involves kind of looking left, looking right, and understanding the broader universe of skills involved in your work. For you as a journalist, it might be fine, you know, get good at doing an interview like this, but also, like, what about the business of running a radio station? Or perhaps what about this technology that I'm dealing with now to have this conversation? Every human follows their own nose if they're given a healthy shot at it. But we need to sort of go broad as we go deep in order to get healthy skill development. And so that sort of isolated, rationalized job approach in factories is, especially with the advanced intelligent tech like robotics that we're deploying now, is the enemy of both challenge and complexity, or at least it can be.
So what's the importance of reflection in complexity?
Right. So the research here is really fascinating. Erikson is one of the founding fathers, so to speak, of the psychology of how we deal with complexity and how we learn. In short, if we're doing a good job of engaging with the complex universe of skills that tasks we're embedded in, you need soak time. You need time away from the action just to process it all. And this is mostly not a conscious or deliberate act. You can do it. So anybody who's been taught to do mental rehearsal or visualization of how they do work, especially somebody in, say, some physical related task like sports or music, they owe a lot to Erikson and this sort of deliberative practice of doing reflective oriented practice. But another part of it is you just need lulls in the work, a ride on the bus, a shower, some time to not consciously, not intentionally, just let the non-conscious parts of your brain process what you've just been through. So you can kind of go, later on the bus on the way back to work, I know why that happened that way yesterday, or I want to go try it differently today. I have a new idea. We don't often build reflection into the way that we build skill, but it's really critical.
And how is it different in the sort of non-expert novice model? Well, why is there a sort of a different emphasis on reflection, or was it part of the old model?
Oh, it certainly was. I mean, and in fact, I don't want to overblow the case. There are plenty of cases throughout the economy right now where reflection is alive and well and critical to skill development. But you can go back I had a great time for this book, going back to pre-Hellenic Greece, even back to the, evidence of, there are people who do the archaeology of apprenticeship, if you can believe it. It's fascinating work. And you can see that time away from work and time away from the task is critical to making new discoveries about new techniques. Say the one ready to mind for me was a pottery shift in pottery techniques from hand pinched pots to a potting wheel. Mm-hmm. That was not invented on the fly, so to speak. It was time away from that, time away from the work that allowed for people to imagine a new way of handling the task.
Now the third C that you talk about is connection. Why is connection increasingly important and difficult in the age of Zoom?
Right. Yeah. And connection, human connection is valuable for so many things. There's a lot of research on warm bonds of trust and respect is the best definition I found. And it's in this work of DC in the psychology of self-determination theory. But in many, many ways, in many places, it's very obvious from research that lots of things don't progress in life unless you have these warm bonds of trust and respect. It just so happens that this is also deeply necessary for getting good at anything. Part of it is access. So you want to get good at whatever task you're involved in, for me being a researcher, for you being a journalist, for anybody else, computer scientist, plumber, you name it. You don't get to try unless someone gives you a shot. You have to earn their trust and respect to even get access to the work. And then once you've got access, you have to perpetually play that game. If you want an opportunity to the next more interesting challenge, that person you're working with who knows more, they have to see that you want to go for it and that you've done well on the previous kind of less complex task. But there's also a portion of it that's about motivation. Like, we talk about skill as if it's somehow divorced from the meaning in our lives. And that's just a strange, if you take a real look at the research, but also our life experience, we try to build skill because we want to earn the trust and respect of those that we look up to. That's part of why we get up in the morning to try hard. You can think back on your own. I certainly can think of my own development and skill. There's always been somebody or a few somebodies, luckily, that I really respected and I want to do well because I want them to be impressed. And that is part of the motivational engine that drives us getting good. It's also from the other side, that expert wants to earn the trust and respect of people coming up the chain. It's just part of what makes a human life well lived. So ignoring human connection or treating it as separate from skill development is a mistake. And yes, as you said, in this world of virtual Zoom-based interaction and so on, I can't tell you the number of inbound tweets and emails I now get from folks saying, my 23, 26-year-old kid is at work and there are managers all around, but they can't find a mentor to save their life. They're all busy. They're all virtual. They're just not connecting.
And, you know, you talk about an example of a manager who does the opposite, who really does reach out to connect. You know, what do you think motivated her to be that proactive in terms of trying to make connections with various people that work directly for her or even indirectly for her?
Right. Yeah. So talk about this is not her real name. I mentioned it's a real scenario, though, of a manager in a software company who just is compelled from before she even entered that company as an undergrad to navigate the world through human connection and relationships. I specialize in studying deviance. I want to highlight that. So I don't think she's representative of the normal human being. I specialize in finding people who are succeeding at building skill in a world that's hostile to building skill. And so she just sort of seemed like the type of person who woke up in the morning and was motivated by, oriented to, and progressed in life through human relationships and bonds of trust and respect. Not all of us are like that, but I think we can all learn from people like that to figure out, like, okay, well, what are the conditions for healthy human connection and how can I cultivate them? And that's what I tried to supply in the book for normal, like, I'm not like that person, Emily. But I learned some lessons from her that I tried to distill in the book.
What is the threat arising from the way in which technology can boost expert productivity at the expense of novice learning?
Yeah, so, and that was the bit that took me after the surgical research that I did and then a few other studies, that took me maybe a couple more years to go out and test. The basic mental picture you should have, and that there are exceptions, but they're rare, is that you create an intelligent technology. A key part of the way the whole world gets value from these technologies is to put it in an expert's hands so they can do more or better with less effort. And the key thing that comes along with that is a part of the way you do that is you rely on people who are less skilled less of the time. More self-serve is the basic mental hook you should use. And if that's true, then the world gets an immediate, maybe sometimes it's not fantastic, sometimes it's just a little bit, sometimes it is fantastic, but you get an immediate productivity boost from putting those technologies to work. I can get my resume or my essay or my memo or my PowerPoint done 10 times faster. It is stupendously amazing. I have to pause and say I'm impressed, incredibly impressed, almost in awe of these technologies we have now. And so it's very hard in that moment of instant productivity boost for an organization or an expert to notice you're also giving up this very subtle but critical relationship with the people who are trying to become you in the next, pick your number, 3, 2, 5 years. And those people are getting kneecapped in their journey towards skill, but there's no, that pain you don't sense for years to come. The novice knows it, but maybe not even. Because they're just trying. They're just trying to learn best they know how. They don't know another way. They don't have a basis for seeing that things are changing so fast.
You know, this feels like we're on a road to something akin to income inequality in the sense of skills inequality. That we're heading for a massive skills inequality, and or we're heading for a world in which we're going to have a bunch of experts who age out before they've taught the novices to take over.
Yes. In principle, in theory, if we just let things go as they are, I think that is the reasonable prediction for what we should see. That is what motivated me to write this book. That is what motivated me to sort of get up in the morning and try to get the word out there about these forces, sort of social forces at work. I want to highlight, by the way, the technology itself is not causing any of the trouble that we're talking about here. We're handling it in a way where we're just choosing to optimize for productivity at the expense of skill development. We don't have to do that. We could design these tools differently and put them to work differently in a way that gets different results. But right now, the train is headed down the track in exactly this direction. Short run productivity hit, long run skill development hit. And I just think it's very obvious we cannot afford that. The back of the envelope math is that's a $1 trillion problem for the economy that will wash up on our shores in the next 3, 5, 10 years. And we need to be learning better now than we ever have given the amount of change. So yes, the book is a wake-up call. The back third of the book is what can we do about it and what solutions are already evident that we could pull together to take an approach where things are even better than they were before, like literally the opposite of a giant problem. So I think we have that opportunity, but if we do nothing, it goes in a very bad direction.
You know, we only have about a minute left. So I want to try to figure out how we can highlight just at a very big picture what you think we ought to do about all this. What are some of the solutions?
Right. So the first thing is that all of us, if we are aware of this issue, can look around our environment with the tools I provide in the book. Hopefully they will help clarify your vision enough to see where is their problem in this area from your point of view, in your context, but also there are people who are figuring out part of what a solution might look like. They just might not be aware they're doing it, and they might not be sharing. And so putting yourself to work, getting other people to work, to finding what's working locally for skill development, you will find some stuff. Put it to work. The next step is redesigning the technology and the way that it's deployed so that it's easier. We're all nudged towards a solution where we can have our productivity and get our skill development as well. Technology vendors have a huge opportunity here. The minute that one of these big AI vendors comes out and says, oh, we've reconfigured our thing so that just by using it, yes, you're going to get 10 times the productivity, but you'll also be a little bit better off in terms of your skill development by the end of the day. And by the way, that includes better connections with human beings. That company is going to win. Mm-hmm. That's just an incredible story. So I hope and expect that they'll start to feel some pressure to make the tool helpful in the journey rather than just sort of the default driving us away from skill.
We've been speaking with Matt Bean about his new book, The Skill Code, a fascinating look at how to save human ability in the age of intelligent machines. Matt, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Again, thank you very much. Delighted to chat.
We'll be right back after this.
Next, we have a married couple who run two different businesses benefiting visitors and locals alike. First, fly fishing's growing popularity contributes to the Wasatch Back as a premier summer destination. Will Manhart of Local Waters tells us about the rise in interest surrounding the sport and why a good guide is important. Will, you've been working, in addition, lest I forget, Will's wife, Katie, runs Lucky Ones Coffee next to the Park City Library. Welcome to Mountain Money, Will and Katie.
Thanks for having us.
Will, you've been working on the Provo River for 9 years. How has fly fishing grown in that time, and why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like everything in this town where people are starting to discover the joys of outdoor recreation. And I think a lot of that has translated to fly fishing. You kind of had that boom during COVID when people could get away from the crowds. And it's definitely brought more people to the river. But in that same aspect, it's just kind of grown the sport in a good way.
So, Will, what motivated you to strike out
on your own and start your own business?
Yeah, I think after you do something for long enough with somebody else, you just kind of see the way you like to do things and the experience you want to provide for people. And I think striking out on my own was a good opportunity to really implement that into what we do every day. And I'm fortunate I've got someone like Katie who said, go for it, give it a go, jump in. So we did just that. And yeah, I've got no complaints about doing it.
And we have a third guest in the studio who you may hear, but doesn't have a lot to say.
No, that's a future fly fishing guide. I think he's booking trips for 2040 if you want to open up your schedule.
So, well, you have a partner in this business?
I do. My partner is Woody Sedaris. He's a local Park City kid. If you've grown up in Park City, you may know him from his football days. I only know him from the fly fishing days. But great guy to get into it with. Super knowledgeable. His whole family's been in town for years. So it's been a really great partnership jumping in with him as well.
Great. You know, I saw that you said you can fish four rivers. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a couple of dams out here that break up our two main rivers into essentially four different rivers, the Provo and the Weber, and there's middle sections and lower sections of both of them. So both of those rivers all produce different fishing experiences, different size fish, different bugs. And then even on top of that, we'll get some folks that come out and they want to go for a unique experience and they've fished for years. And we have a number of smaller rivers that on years just like this one right now, when the water is really good, we're able to get them onto some smaller streams and do that as well.
You know, for people who haven't had the opportunity to go fly fishing with a guide, talk to us a little bit about what you supply and what the experience is like.
Yeah, great question. We supply everything. We have waders, boots, rods, reels, these specific flies that are specialized on these local waters. We have all of that as well. And then just experience wise, it's nice when you go out with a guide. Yeah, they're going to get you into fish and they're going to tell you what they're eating. But let's say it's a busy day or the water's high like it was earlier this year. As guides, we kind of have a plan A, B, C, D as far as what the day is going to look like. And it just makes it so that people who maybe aren't as comfortable with it or who have never touched a fly rod are going to go out, feel comfortable, have a great time. And where if we say in a very corny way, we're in the business of making memories, and that's what we're looking to do. We want people to walk away saying they had a great time, they felt comfortable, safe, and enjoyed the day out there.
So what are your top suggestions for those beginners like me?
We like to say if you are striking out on your own, our phrase is kind of embrace the suck a little bit. There's going to be some tangles. There's going to be some hard times. And we think having a guide ameliorates a little bit of that and shortens that learning curve. But, you know, we get out and we can give people the tools to do it on their own. And then once you get out there on your own, it's just a matter of repetition. Every day gets a little better. Every day is a little different. Just spending time on the river, you're gonna see what bugs are hatching, you're gonna see where the fish are, and it all just kind of starts to piece itself together in that puzzle. And I think that's why so many people enjoy doing this, is because they're able to create their own experience and figure things out more and more every day on their own.
Well, give us a sense of how large a group you can accommodate. How many people do you have? What's the ratio of novices to experts from the topic we've just been talking about, or in this case, sort of guests to guides? And are you able to sort of, you know, supplement your group with other guides if you need it for a larger group?
Absolutely. I think the largest group we've done is 28 people.
That's a large group.
That's a decently yeah. large group. And, you know, we take out one person fairly often as well. So anywhere really in that range. And it's funny you say supplementing it with other guides. I think in this industry, it's very much community based. So it really teaches you, you know, be a good steward on the river, work well with these other people that are out there enjoying it. And that goes for whether you're just doing it yourself or with a guide. And we're able to bring on guides from some of the other outfitters. We work hand in hand with them and vice versa. So for those larger groups, and with the experience that we have, we're able to find those guides that do things in a very hospitality-minded way. But at the end of the day, they're going to put you in the fish too. So it really works out well. And it's fun for us. We enjoy that. Trip's over. You have a beer with your buddies. That's kind of what it's all about.
And again, I'm a beginner, so tell me what kind of cost I'm looking at when going for the first time.
Definitely. As far as going with a guide, like I said, we would provide everything. But if you're striking out on your own, you would want to get a good fly rod, fly reel, and fly line. Then you kind of get not so much nickel and dimed, but you do have to start picking up flies and leaders and weights and indicators and all these things that start to make more sense the more you do it. But for a fly rod, fly reel, and fly line, I would say you can get a good serviceable rod, reel, line combo for about $300. I always tell people, you find that price point and just find something that has a warranty on it, because we're all gonna put it into a ceiling fan or a car door or break it on the fish of a lifetime that might have been a rock maybe, and you're gonna wanna be able to replace that. So find something with a warranty, that's gonna be good quality, and that's what you're gonna wanna roll with there. And all of the local fly shops, Trout Bum, Jan's, Fish Heads down in Heber, they're all gonna help set you up. So pop in there and those guys will know what to get you going with.
And Will, if you were gonna, what's a typical price point for a half day for two people who wanna go with you?
Absolutely, our half day price point is $390 for two people, and that includes, like I said, the waders, the boots, the rods, reel, flies, and really pick our brain. That's kind of the thing too. We say, you know, you pay for all of that, but the knowledge is free. And we love telling people what's going on out there. We'll tell you exactly what the fish are looking to do. So yeah, $390 for all of that. And that's about 4 hours of fishing, about 5 hours all told between getting waded up, getting down to the river, and all that good stuff. So that's a two-person half day for us.
And where are you located?
Yeah, we are based out of Heber, just down there. It gets it so we're a little bit more mobile. We're able to either pick people up or meet people on the river, which gets us to where the fishing conditions are usually the best for that time of year, time of month, time of day even. So we are based out of Heber.
Okay. And your website is?
We are localwatersparkcity.com. And you could just check us out even on Instagram or anything like that with Local Waters Guide Service.
Okay. Katie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Katie, so you guys were shut for a while. What was the deal?
Yes. So we just re-signed. This last year, we re-signed for another 5 years at the library. And with that, we had asked for some tenant improvement budget, and we're granted that through the city. And so it was just finally we found the time to close up for a minute and make some remodels that we're really excited about.
I'm curious what your initial idea was when starting Lucky Ones Coffee.
Yeah, so we started, we're about 6 years in now. Both Taylor, who's the co-founder, and myself used to work at NAC, and we ran the camps program and did a lot of the family programs there. And through that, we kind of saw a huge need in the community for adult programming and employment, long-term employment, that there's a lot of internships out there, but there's not that long-term place that you can continue to learn and grow in.
And you mentioned programs. I know that you opened the campus location, and I know one of the ambitions there was to do some new programming. Where are you on thinking about new programming that sort of goes beyond sort of running a coffee shop?
Yeah, we're really excited. We've been working in this last year. There's a few things that we needed to get in place before we could start that programming. So kind of last grant cycle, we wrote some grants to get us the funds to buy all the kitchen equipment. So all of that is set up in there now. We're working currently on getting our website redone so that there will be a live link for all of the cooking classes, adult meal prep classes, and then we're also going to do some social classes on there as well. And so it'll have, you know, a monthly calendar that people can go online and sign up. So we're working through our website's just about finished. The shop is all set up, and then we worked with PC Caps this last year, and they helped us with some of the programming and scheduling for that. So that should go live this fall.
And what are some of the programs you're going to be doing?
Yeah, so we're going to be doing cooking classes, and these will be just community-based. So we'll do both inclusive cooking classes. Well, everything will be inclusive. But we'll also do it where it's open to the community. So some of them will just be for individuals with disabilities who are looking to learn cooking skills that they can use in their own homes. We'll also be doing some adult meal prep classes, and this will be for adults in the community who live on their own that may not be able to use a stove or an oven at their house. And so a lot of those adults are living off like lean cuisine. And so this would allow us to provide a program that would both be social, that we can get together and meet, but they would take home nutritious meals at the end of the day. And then obviously some community cooking classes. So we'll do, you know, cooking classes around Christmas time and some of those ideas. And eventually, hopefully, we've been partnering with some chefs around town that we'll bring into the space and get to do some like supper clubs.
And tell me, going back to your all-inclusive environment, what are the specific benefits of employing those with disabilities?
Yeah, so for us, we see it as a huge market that, you know, in a town that it's so hard to find employees, that we have a large pool of employees to hire from that show up early, that pick up shifts, that are excited to be at work and excited to continue to learn, and especially like stepping into some of the leadership roles around our shop, that our staff is really great and they're excited to be there, and that's really hard to find. But yeah, we love what we do.
Right. I worked for Special Olympics years ago, and I know that the athletes we worked with were very interested in creating their own lives.
Yeah, it's that's our mission with our nonprofit. So we are a nonprofit. We have a nonprofit umbrella over everything. And then each coffee shop is run under its own LLC under that umbrella, just so we can track kind of how we're growing. But as far as that, it's so important, because even just working at the coffee shop, that I'm like, it's a spot that people can stay long term, but then also like coworkers that you don't get that many other places, where all of our staff has a disability. And so you're getting invited to birthday parties, you're getting invited to graduation parties. And our staff is a big sense of community that it's hard to find other places.
So Katie, I wanted to touch one more time back to the remodel. What'd you do? In other words, like how is there new equipment? Is there new space?
Yeah, so we got kind of creative. All the equipment is still in there. We moved things around kind of to make it function better. We have been operating in the space now for 6 years, and we inherited the space, you know, with laminate counters that were peeling, and, you know, we've made it work. And so we are so excited that we added new counters and cabinets in the back and redid all of the plumbing and the whole back room. There was never lights behind the wall before, and that for us is very exciting. But really just cleaned it up. It's going to make it so it's going to function a lot better for us. It's going to make it so that we, everything's on wheels so we can roll it out. It'll be much easier to get everything clean in there. And then most of like the cabinets that we added into the space have drawers, so it makes it more functional for our staff as well, who may have mobility issues that it's hard to get down and get low to look into cabinets. So yeah, really, and we opened up one last spot of it that had been closed off that made it not fully ADA. And so we opened up that spot, so it's fully ADA.
Well, finally, I want to know how, this is for both of you, how do your different businesses leave you any time together with your two young children, one of whom has joined us today?
Yeah, well, we're here right now. Not the whole family here.
We're missing one.
There's a lot of multitasking and a lot of communication, and I think our calendar in the kitchen becomes the most important thing in the household, just planning handoffs, transfers, and all that.
Yeah, I think it's we're very reflective of being a true Park City couple, that almost everyone has crazy schedules, but it's also why we love living here, that I think just the lifestyle here, even that people are okay that you can bring your baby to KPCW, and yeah. I bring him to the library sometimes, and people hold him and love on him, and yeah, he's very lucky for that.
Well, we won't be asking him for a donation. We've been speaking with Will Manhart and Will Manhart of Local Water Fishing and Katie Holyfield of Lucky Ones Coffee. Thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this.
The exclusive Blue Sky Lodge in Wanship offers a plethora of things to do. Here to tell us about summer offerings open to the public is Alex Hudson. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wild Kitchen Restaurant, designed by British filmmaker Guy Ritchie, is featured in the Netflix series The Gentlemen. What is the connection to Blue Sky Lodge?
So Wild Kitchen is our newest dinner concept up at Blue Sky, and it's kind of a tented kitchen. There's nothing else like it in the country, and there's only a few like it in the world. And so the connection was made between Blue Sky and Auberge and Guy Ritchie, and we went out to just outside of London and tested out, and we just knew that it would be the perfect fit for Blue Sky because that's what we're all about, being off the grid and having a luxury experience.
I want to hear a little more about Wildfire, but let's take a step back. Tell us a little bit about the big picture of what Blue Sky is.
Yeah, great. Yeah, so Blue Sky is a lodge, ranch, and resort. We are located in Wanship, Utah. We have 46 rooms, and we are managed by an Auberge resort. In addition to that, I'd love to tell everyone that we are first and foremost a family-owned and operated business. So we love having the name of Auberge behind us, but I've lived in Park City area for over 20 years with my parents, and my parents bought the land in 2004. And we always knew that we wanted to share that with the community. So we kind of have the best of both worlds with Auberge and Blue Sky. But we also have another element of Blue Sky called Gracie's Farm. And we're about 10 minutes down the road from the lodge site. We have a farm down there, and then we also have a rescue that was started by Barb Phillips, my mom, who had an experience in rescued horses. So just they're all integrated. We have Blue Sky, we have the lodge, we have a working ranch, and then just down the road we have our vegetable farm, Gracie's Farm, and then we also have the Equine Rescue and Rehab Foundation.
Going back to Wild Kitchen, when is the restaurant open for seating? Is this an everyday restaurant or?
So I believe the restaurant is open Wednesday through Sunday. Joe's not here to confirm on this.
Okay.
Farm, I think. Wednesday through Sunday, we have a bunch of visiting chefs, and we have one seating per night at 7:30. People who are not staying at the lodge can book directly through our website, or Wild Kitchen's just on Open Table, just like any other restaurant as well. This weekend, we have an amazing chef named Ivan Mucharaz, and he used to be the executive chef at Chileno Bay, which is also another Auberge property, and he's coming out. He's very well-rounded chef, and I like to think a little bit famous. And he will be doing this weekend's Wild Kitchen. So lots of fun people up there.
So let me try to understand it. Again, it's radio, so it's hard to visualize. You say it's a tented kitchen? Is the restaurant outside?
Yes. So we have a large deck. We take people meet at the lodge site. We drive them up to the Wild Kitchen. It's a big, large deck with panoramic views of Park City and Deer Valley. And then it's like a wall tent, kind of. And then the kitchen is integrated into the wall tent. So the kitchen arrived in a large shipping container from Europe and was able to be constructed within one day. Because the tented concept includes everything from the cooking materials to the wall tent to everything. And all we had to do was build the foundation for it to sit on.
So you get dinner and a ride in an ATV or somehow you get up there?
Yes, you do. Or we also offer guests can sign up for a hike up to the Wild Kitchen, which would leave a little bit sooner. So you can get your adventuring in and then go to dinner. And it's an interactive experience. So they're cooking over open flames, charcoal.
Great. Well, you'd mentioned Gracie's Kitchen, and I know you've got events throughout the summer. What's happening this week?
So the upcoming events that we have at the farm, we do our farm dinners, which we have a lovely community of locals who have made our Gracie's Farm dinners so successful. And so we have our garlic dinner, because garlic is one of our favorite crops to grow. And that is on the 16th, I believe. You can sign up directly through our website. There's a booking link there. And then beyond that, we have another dinner that I'm very excited about called the Queen Bee's Dinner. We are highlighting women in the food and agriculture space, most of which are local here to Utah. And honestly, it was quite hard to narrow down all of the amazing women right here in this community and outside of it. So we're excited to highlight that at the farm. And that one's on July 25th.
Okay.
Go ahead, Kath.
We understand you have an outstanding executive chef heading up all of Blue Sky's culinary program. What is his background and expertise?
So Chef Guillermo is our new executive chef at Blue Sky. He has he's very experienced. He is, I have found him to be so professional, and I couldn't be more excited about the direction that Blue Sky is going with their executive chef. He, and I can't speak for his every single thing, but he grew up and worked in the Charlie Trotter, and he was in Las Vegas. But most recently, he was at Flora Farms in outside of Cabo. And so that was attractive to us because we have the farm on property. And that's really exactly what he's doing. He's really utilizing For the Wild Kitchen and all of the food and beverage that we do, utilizing Gracie's Farm, and kind of, in my opinion, taking Blue Sky's culinary program to the next level. He's amazing.
Well, that's great.
So tell us about Smokewood.
Smokewood is our newest barbecue concept. It is a food truck that is like you've never seen before. I've never seen a food truck built quite like David Williams built this one. He calls it Texas Craft Barbecue. And from what I understand, as a person who has never lived in Texas, this is a very specific kind of barbecue. He is doing that every Friday at Gracie's Farm. So this is open to the public as well as guests who are staying at Blue Sky. And we do it in conjunction with our farm stand, which we do on Fridays from 4 to 6, 7-ish. And then his service starts at, I believe it's 5, maybe 5:30.
What's on his menu? What kind of, you know?
So the classics, really. He's got ribs, he's got brisket, he's got chicken, he's got turkey. He smokes it for several days before he brings it on Friday. Does most of the cooking right there in his trailer, in his big state-of-the-art smokers. And then he has some sides that are really reminiscent to him of where he is from. Mac and cheese, potatoes, cornbread, coleslaw. And I think he also does a couple sandwiches too. So he's got a really well-rounded barbecue menu.
And isn't there a communal table concept there at Smokewood?
Yes, so it's kind of a casual setup where we put picnic tables out by the farm stand. And so groups can sit together. We have some lounge furniture too. So you can just kind of show up and sit where you find.
Alex, we focused a lot this morning on the culinary aspects of the lodge. Let's take a step back. What is the sort of stay of a visitor typically like? What are the various activities? You know, what's the scope of the resort?
Yeah. We pride ourselves on not only the culinary journey that you have when you get to Blue Sky, but also the adventures that you'll do when you stay there, if you are so interested. We have, a guest can participate in food and beverage, a beautiful spa program that is, one of the best parts of staying at Blue Sky. And then as far as adventures go, we offer a world-class sporting clay course that we have, and we have a club membership, and then we also have our guests who do sporting clays with us. We have the farm, and you can go take a farm school and tour and learn about our regenerative sustainable farming methods. We have horseback riding, and we offer several different experiences under the umbrella of horseback riding, you know, one just being a trail ride during the summer, or we have Western riding experiences, lessons that you can do in our amazing indoor arena. So adventure is what we really specialize in, I think, being from here and being adventurers ourselves.
Now, I take it a clay course is not about making pottery.
No, the clay pigeons or clay birds, they call them. We don't have any hunting on property. Barb is an animal lover advocate, and so we always have made sure that our program in any way fits in with our love of the animals and the land. And so our sporting clay course, we just shoot clay pigeons in reminiscent of a European style that that they do in Sweden and England. And so this is called driven bird shooting, and it's a way of shooting a shotgun that is a lot of times unlike anyone who come visits us has done before.
For all the summer events at Blue Sky, where can our listeners find more information?
So the best place to find an all-around view of what we have going on is the Blue Sky website. So that's aubergeresorts.com/Blue Sky. And then Gracie's Farm has their own Instagram, Gracie's Farm Blue Sky. And then the Animal Rescue and Foundation also has a great Instagram, Saving Gracie Foundation. And so those are like the three parts that I always visit to see what's going on.